Available now, She Says, a new investigative podcast about sexual assault from WFAE. Listen to the first episode of She Says on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and WFAE.org/She Says.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The number of those who are religiously unaffiliated is on the rise, not just around the country, but throughout the South, including North Carolina. In addition, studies from the Pew Research Center show that the number of Christians is declining mainly within mainline Protestant denominations and among Catholics. They also report that people who self-identify as atheists or agnostics, as well as those who say their religion is nothing in particular, now account for about 23% of the population, and that number is even higher among younger people. So, what is driving this, and how might it affect our society and our politics? We explore that this hour with Sean McLeod. He's professor and director of graduate studies in the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back to the program.
Morning.
He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with Tim Funk, who reports on faith and values for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning. Welcome back to you.
Morning.
Nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
With us by phone is Sigal Samuel, associate editor of The Atlantic, who covers both religion and global affairs. Thank you for being with us, too.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let me begin with this question. Is America becoming more secular specifically because fewer people self-identify as Christian, or because people in America are falling away from all religious affiliation, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever it may be? Anybody know the answer to that question? I'll take it to you, Sean, because you're the professor here.
Yeah, I'll have the first go at this. And what I'll actually say is that the United States is not becoming more secular. When it comes to things like beliefs in supernatural beings, gods, for example, or a god, there's been very little change. What we have seen in the rise of the nuns since...
N-O-N-E-S.
N-O-N-E-S, yes. Yes, not Catholic nuns. They're actually declining quite a bit. But the people who are religiously unaffiliated are still sums, meaning that they still have beliefs and practices, but they don't want to affiliate themselves, or at least in polls, don't want to say they're members of institutions. So that's not being secular, but it's moving away from religious institutions.
So let me get this straight, because this goes against everything I read yesterday in preparation for this. You're saying that America is not becoming more secular, despite the fact that the number of atheists, people who identify as atheists, has doubled in recent years, and people are falling away from both mainline Christian churches, including the Catholic Church, and other evangelical denominations of Christianity. We're not becoming more secular, that's what you're saying?
Right.
So and where are the people who are falling away from Christian belief going if we're not increasing secularization? I'm sorry.
Right. And two things about that. First, that actually if you read the Pew polls and the Harris polls and all the polls, the entire United States still in these polls only have 1% of all Americans calling themselves atheists, about 2% calling themselves agnostics. So even if you put them into the lump sum of those who say that they are unaffiliated, that's still only about 10 to 11% of all unaffiliated people. So where they're going is they're going to more privatized practices and beliefs. You'll find that most still pray, most still believe in a god or some sort of powerful supernatural being, but they're not sitting in church pews.
So the people who say they have no affiliation, that we call nuns, N-O-N-E-S's, they simply don't identify with a sect or a denomination.
Yeah, I think a lot of them are young people who maybe grew up in a church are now turned off by churches because they say there's too many rules, there's too much interest in money, too much interest in politics in these churches. And a lot of them, as he said, do sort of a do-it-yourself spirituality. They may do yoga. They may find spiritual sustenance in hiking or gathering with friends on a Sunday morning in South End for brunch rather than go to a church. And then there are groups like there's a group called Sunday Assembly Charlotte, which is a group of mostly non-believers, and they gather on Sundays and they sing and they have a sermon, but they don't really believe in a doctrine.
So it's church without God.
Yeah, essentially. I think they still want that community experience. And instead of singing a hymn, they may play John Lennon's Imagine, which the first lines are, Imagine there's no heaven. So they even have life after faith or life after church meetups. So,
Do people who identify as nuns or who fall away from whatever they were whatever tradition they were raised in, do they tend to continue to distance themselves as life goes on, or do they tend to gravitate back toward something, whether it's the faith tradition they were raised in or something new and different for them? Anybody know the? Is there any study that talks about that?
Go ahead. Sure. I would just, not from a study, but just to take a crack at that in a more anecdotal way, I think people, there's a bit of a pendulum swing. So people do, religiosity is something that's sort of fluid throughout life, and people do kind of come back and forth a little bit throughout their lives. But I would say especially around the certain like kind of ritual crux moments in life, so especially, you know, birth, marriage, death, when it comes to those pivotal moments in our lives or the lives of those we love, those are moments when people often kind of would swing back a little bit towards the ritual life of the religious faith that they've come from. I think largely because like the religions provide a script for dealing with those moments and often dealing with those moments in kind of psychologically beneficial ways. So you do see people who are quite secular in the course of their daily lives, but suddenly they're getting married, and you see they want to be married in a church or a synagogue or whatever it is.
Is that for ceremony, or is there some other spiritual component to that?
I think it's both, right? I mean, I think it's for the ceremony, but it's also people have a sense. You know, we're really conditioned from a young age. We have this sense that these are really important moments in life, so we want to. It feels like there ought to be some ritual around it. And psychologically, you know, religions have evolved over the course of millennia to provide kind of psychologically adaptive, mechanisms to kind of hold us in those transitional moments in life. So there are good reasons why people turn back toward faith in those moments where they maybe feel a little unmoored.
I mean, I suppose it's one thing if you're a non-believer or you're a nun who still N-O-N-E, who still believes but doesn't practice. I suppose it's one thing to go to somebody else's wedding or somebody else's funeral in a church, but to have your own wedding and your own funeral in a church, is that at all hypocritical?
Well, certain churches have rules that they will not marry people unless they are active in their church or active in the faith. But a lot of churches are, it's become a marketing situation where a lot of churches are on decline, so they're trying to do things to bring in young people. Yeah, so they have, you don't wear your Sunday best anymore, you wear casual, you have contemporary music, you have a vibrant children's programs, because as some young people get older, they get married, they also want something for their children in some cases. So there's a lot of competition between churches and town.
You wrote an article a couple of years ago about, and you interviewed several people, but one of the young men that you talked about who acknowledged that he's a nun rejected the do's and don'ts of organized religion, but he still identified himself as being spiritual. I'm curious about two things. What does that mean? And what does it mean to society at large if large numbers of people are rejecting the do's and don'ts of religion?
Well, and I think I remember this particular gentleman, and I found him at the Common Market on Sunday morning while a lot of other people were in church. And he said he enjoys just going out and sort of connecting with nature. That was his way of connecting with what his belief in a God is, a higher power. A lot of nuns don't necessarily believe in the God in the Bible, but they do believe there's something there and that they want to connect with that. So I think that's a lot of what's going on, that it's not a rejection of spirituality, meaning that there's something beyond me, but they don't necessarily buy into the God that they read about in the Bible or that they were taught about growing up, I think.
Do you find that the people who reject the do's and don'ts are the people who were raised in the fire and brimstone tradition, or just simple mainline Protestant and/or Catholic tradition of love thy neighbor, don't steal, etc.?
I think you find both. I think you find a lot of lapsed Catholics. The joke is that Catholics make up the number one or the most popular. Well, there are more Catholics in the United States than any other denomination, and lapsed Catholics are supposed to be number two. So a lot of people fall off of mainline religion, Christianity as well.
So, Segal, if I understand your writing on this, some have said that professing your spirituality over your religiosity or identification with a specific religion can sometimes be the first step toward adopting atheism. And you also report that in America, those who have stepped away from religion but remained spiritual and still pray to a God makes it more difficult to pinpoint exactly where we are in terms of people stepping away from religion.
That's right. So one of my sources who I recently interviewed, she's a professor of religion in the UK, Linda Woodhead, she said that she hypothesizes that being spiritual may be a transitional position between being Christian and being non-religious. I personally disagree with that analysis, at least in the U.S. context. I think in Europe, it's a bit of a different ballgame there. But here in the U.S., I think there's this tempting, inclination to see a sort of, sliding scale where you have Christian or whatever religion, spiritual but not religious, and then secular or atheist, on the other end of the spectrum. I don't really think that's accurate, because I think a lot of people who would call themselves spiritual but not religious, as 27% of Americans do, still pray or meditate regularly, still believe in God, whether it's, maybe not the God as described in the Bible, but some form of higher power guiding the universe. So it's really like a lot more complicated than we tend to think. And This is both like a problem and an interesting challenge for researchers, because it's really scrambling, what we typically think of when we think of the word religion.
Is it easier to make that assessment in Europe?
I think Europe is a bit of a different thing. So Europe is far more secular overall, and there are far fewer Europeans who would call themselves spiritual but not religious. So you see, but even in Europe, you see people who would say, I don't believe in God, and I'm absolutely certain I don't believe in God, but they still believe in the idea of the soul. They still believe in these sort of ideas that we would think of as spiritual or supernatural. So it's not, it's not a direct line or a direct drop-off into, like, a free fall into atheism by any means.
When Segal started talking about this, Sean, you were shaking your head pretty, nodding pretty vigorously here in agreement with her.
Yeah, Segal's spot on, because, Lynn Woodhead does excellent work, but she is a sociologist, and sociologists define things by the things they study. They study groups, they study institutions. So if you're thinking institutionally, then you can talk about a move away and a transition into, atheism, perhaps through spirituality. Not only is that not the case in the United States, but non-sociologists studying religion academically would question why we might place religious institutions as the main way to define what religion is. So a lot of those people that we study that call themselves spiritual but not religious still look religious to us. But they look religious in a non-institutional way.
I'm not sure I understand a single word you said. But clearly you do.
I think we should also say that there is a more high-profile atheist and agnostic group out there who read about Richard Dawkins and others. And there's a group called Charlotte Atheists and Agnostics, and I'll talk about it when we return.
We'll take a break. Tim Funk is with us from the Charlotte Observer, Sean McLeod from UNC Charlotte, and Segal Samuel with The Atlantic. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. The Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup is on the road this week. We'll be live from the HeroesCon Comic Book Convention at the Charlotte Convention Center. Grab your cape, your ray gun, your lightsaber, and stop by Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rise in people. I was going to say the rise in the secular nature of America, except that Sean McLeod, one of our guests, says that's not true. So we'll talk about the rise in the religiously unaffiliated. Would that be a way to say it?
I like that better.
Okay. Sean McLeod, professor and director of graduate studies in the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Sigal Samuel joins us by phone. She's an associate editor who writes about religion and global affairs for The Atlantic. And Tim Funk, faith and values reporter for the Charlotte Observer. You were talking about an atheist group.
In Charlotte. They may not have the numbers, but they do have the profile. I think many of us in Charlotte remember back in 2010, the Charlotte Atheists and Agnostics put up a billboard on Billy Graham Parkway, quoting the old version of the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation indivisible rather than one nation under God. So I went and did a story on them, and it turns out that even they are into community, and they have atheist picnics and atheist book club. And so I think there's this sort of, they even have their own kind of version of prophets and saints, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Carl Sagan, Bertrand Russell. So I think there must be something there that people want to gather, whether they believe or not.
You brought up the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation, indivisible, which is what it used to be until, I think, the 1950s. At the same time, that's when In God We Trust found its way, I think, into
paper money.
The paper money. Sigal, you've written about this in The Atlantic, and
yes.
you were told in the course of your research that our history, America's history, is crucial to understanding why secularization here is not as profound as that you find, what you'll find in Europe. And it dates back to the most religious period in American history, the 1950s. Talk about that.
That's right. So Joseph Blankholm, who's a professor at UC Santa Barbara, pointed out that the 1950s were really the most religious America has ever been. So as you said, that's when we see In God We Trust become the official national motto. Under God is entered into the Pledge of Allegiance. And the really like useful thing to understand about that is that this identity, we shouldn't take it for granted. It was being consciously formed for pretty political reasons. So you had specific people like Truman, Eisenhower, who were promoting a Christian identity over against a godless communism out there, right? So it's, he said, it's the Christianization of America as a Cold War tool. And I think we may tend to think of, you know, everyone knows that Americans overall are quite religious people, but it's not some kind of natural state of affairs, you know, like it's programmed into our DNA, right? This is socially bred and constructed for historical and political reasons, so I think that's useful to keep in mind.
So is it as simple as that, really, that we were fighting godless communism, or at least we named it godless communism? Was it that we knew that if we called it godless, the churched people in America would be on board immediately? Or was it that cynical?
Well, you know, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't think it's so much if we call them godless, you know, Americans here will be on our side. I think it's actually the something more striking. It's the construction of America, of American identity as a God-based people. And then, you know, that helps you, by contrast, set up the other, the foreign other, as a godless people.
Well, those of us in Charlotte remember that it was the 1950s when Billy Graham emerged as sort of the national representation of this religious revival. And he talked a lot about godless communism. Of course, later he went to the Soviet Union and other countries behind the Iron Curtain. But he went to talk and pray with presidents, and he talked about communism. And it just was a time of, I think, a lot of people wanted to maybe conform than now. So church rates of attendance were pretty high. But it was a different time, and I think Billy Graham also had a lot of things going for him. He looked like a movie star. He was a striking speaker.
And he came along at the time that television was emerging
as a
force in America, not just political, but in other ways. And he wasn't the only preacher to make use of television over the years. But when President Trump, who has strong support among evangelicals, says he wants to make America great again, is that what he's referencing, the 1950s, where they felt they were at home in their country because their country was grounded in faith and values? Sean?
You're looking at me. Uh-oh. Broach that topic. I think that, and this goes a little away from religion, right? But when President Donald Trump's talking about making America great again, there's a lot of racialized undercurrent in that. That doesn't have a lot to do with religion at all.
But through the lens of evangelicals who may or may not be racist and who don't consider themselves racist, is that what hits home to them, the fact he wants to go back to that earlier time in America that was, in fact, more religious or more welcoming to believers?
Yeah, and we don't know what's inside his rhetoric and where that rhetoric comes from. I would note, however, that I think we're doing a disservice to say that evangelicals vote for Trump and voted for Trump. That's only a particular class of white evangelicals. 90% of all African-American Protestants are evangelical by the five-point definition of evangelicalism. They generally, when they vote Democratic, and in fact, they're the folks who change the vote to a Democratic senator in the state of Alabama. So we have to I don't think we should generalize all evangelicals into one group, and there are age differences in voting as well and gender differences.
But 81% of the white evangelicals did vote for Trump.
Yes.
And I feel like they voted for him because they wanted a Supreme Court justice that would agree with them on abortion, things like that. I don't think they were necessarily saying that Donald Trump is a great man of faith. I think it was an alliance they were willing to make to get their agenda passed.
Okay.
And that's what Franklin Graham and others constantly say on their Facebook. This is our guy.
So according to the Public Religion Research Institute, white Christians, once the dominant group in America, now account for fewer than half of all adults living in the country. And when you combine that with the decline of white evangelical Protestants, along with white mainline Protestants and white Catholics, and the concurrent growth of non-religious groups, is that's what's driving Make America Great Again. I keep harping back on that, but there's got to be a religious element to it, it seems.
I think there's a religious element in that, you know, there was a time when the church and state, the wall between church and state was not what it is now. There was a time when kids in public schools prayed every day. There was a time when abortion was illegal. And I think Billy Graham and Franklin Graham and the evangelicals sort of hark back to that period. And I think, frankly, I think Donald Trump saw that he could sort of connect with those people, and whether he personally believes it or not.
So we talked about the historical nature of the United States and why an historical understanding is critical to understanding what's going on here, religiously speaking, in terms of the secularization of America, if that's in fact happening. It's not it's already happened to a great degree in Europe, but they experienced communism. Why are they more secular than the United States, Sean?
I'm afraid I'm not much of a scholar when it comes to Europe.
Seagal,
I can speak a lot better
to
the U.S.
I'm not much of a scholar when it comes to Europe either, but I mean, Europe has, I mean, obviously Europe is a big place, right? So we have different scenarios in Europe. France is a bit of a very special case. They have a very, very hardline secularism or a strong flavor of laïcité, sort of state secularism, which, you know, evolves as a kind of reactionary opposition to strong institutionalized religion there, at a previous point in history. But I think in other parts of Europe, for example, in the UK, again, it's this sort of misconception of thinking that religiously unaffiliated means completely irreligious, right? And I agree with what's been said by others here that it's we really like want to get clearer on that confusion, because it's really not that people have secularized necessarily or become atheists. It's just that they are rejecting institutionalized religion. So in Europe, you have people who are very, very alienated by scandals that the church has been through, especially sex abuse scandals. In the 90s, we saw this come up a lot in Ireland with the recent abortion debate there. It's one reason why religion is not playing much of a role even in such political debates now, because people just want to have nothing to do with those institutions. They want to disaffiliate from the old authority figures. And so you see people moving toward a more independent-minded set of beliefs where they just want to engage with spiritual ideas, but they want to sift them themselves. So it's a little bit of a trickier picture.
So the trend away from having a specific religious identity is particularly pronounced among younger people. Would that be accurate to say between 18 and 34? Would that be accurate?
Yeah, generationally.
Isn't that normal? Haven't traditionally a lot of young people who leave home, leave mom and dad's home, strike out on their own, try to build their own life, start exploring what they believe in, sometimes drop away from their faith traditions until they get married and have children and come back to it? Isn't that what normally happens, or in many cases?
That would be the time, but we do have longitudinal evidence throughout the 20th century that the baby boomers are the first generation to about 50% of all baby boomers switched their religions at some point. Generation Xers were a group that switched more, about 60%, and also were more likely to be nuns or unaffiliated.
And when you say switch, you mean they switched from, maybe they were raised Methodist and they became Baptist or vice versa?
Anything as small as Methodist to a different type of Methodist to a Buddhist. Yeah.
Okay.
And then we have millennials, who are more likely than all the other groups to be unaffiliated and to switch.
Well, in fact, they are being called the least religious generation in American history. Agree with that?
No, because, again, only if you define religion as belonging to an institution. If you think religion has something to do with practices and beliefs that have to do with supernatural things, then no, not at all.
You are a troublemaker. So, Seagal, I don't know where I read this, but I read this yesterday from a reputable source saying that millennials are being called the least religious generation in American history. Have you heard that? Do you agree with it?
I have heard it, and I also disagree with it. Sorry to be a troublemaker. But, again, we come to the language thing, right? I think that actually I want to point out an April survey that Pew put out where it was called, "When Americans Say They Believe in God, What Do They Mean?" And I think this is the most useful kind of drilling down, because I think a lot of confusion that arises around religion, and it's amazing how many debates are animated by this language confusion. Our language often fails us when we talk about religion, or we fail it because we're not being precise enough. This Pew study showed, if you sit down with two guys, both, you ask them about their beliefs, both say they believe in some sort of a higher power, but one calls this higher power God, and the other doesn't want to call it God. So if you were to just ask them, "Do you believe in God?" they will give you opposite answers, and it will appear that they have diametrically opposed beliefs. But in fact, they have the exact same belief in a higher power, right? So I think getting really, really specific about our religious language helps us here. And if we talk about millennials and we talk about religion, they might kind of, feel queasy about that word. But a lot of them are looking for many of the core ingredients that religious groups or spiritual groups provide. There was a great report called How We Gather, put out kind of in conjunction with Harvard Divinity School in 2015, that found that there are six kind of recurring themes that they see millennials reaching for, and they turn to non-religious organizations for these sort of spiritual things. And those organizations can include things like CrossFit or SoulCycle. Just briefly, the six things they look for are community, personal transformation, social transformation, purpose finding, creativity, and accountability. So often they're looking for these things in groups that we wouldn't ordinarily think of as spiritual, like CrossFit. Often millennials, I'm part of that group, so not to speak for all of us, but often millennials can be very very much opting for syncretism. So you'll see someone, engaging in Buddhist meditation 1 hour and in the next hour running off to a Shabbat dinner. And that's very, very common, that kind of mix and match attitude.
Tim?
I think you could say that millennials are the least church-going generation, perhaps. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
Yes.
And even saying that, if you look at, in Charlotte, if you look at Elevation Church,
yes.
And in other cities, Summit Church and other names, sort of non-religious sounding names, they've dropped their denominational titles. Elevation is a Southern Baptist church, but every weekend, 20,000 or more people gravitate to their nine or so campuses for a very spiritual experience. But it's dropped a lot of the trappings. You're not going to hear organ music there. You're not going to dress in your suits and things like that.
It's like going to a concert.
Yeah,
with a strong message.
And you have a very tech-savvy media presentation, and you often have a pastor who's charismatic, and he may drop references to pop culture as much as the Bible. So I think they have figured out that a lot of young people do want to go to church, a certain kind of church.
Two things, and this is anecdotal, but I've had the experience now four times teaching UNC Charlotte students. Some of those people who, if they were asked in a poll, would say they were none, actually attend Elevation Church.
Well, so I was going to ask, is Elevation, in the absence of a church like Elevation, would these be people who simply don't spend Sunday morning in church? They'd be at brunch.
Yeah, so some of those nuns actually are attending things, but they're not officially affiliating with those things.
Seagal, I don't know how familiar you are with Elevation Church. They're available online everywhere all the time. And, of course, they have Sunday morning services at campuses all over this city. Tim referenced the 20,000 people who attend all over this city, and they're talking about going worldwide. Whether or not you are familiar with them and their pastor, Stephen Furtick, who is a showman and also a pretty effective spiritual leader. Are there other churches like Elevation throughout the United States that are attracting similar attention?
I mean, one thing I find really fascinating is this phenomenon of atheist churches, right? Which is kind of oxymoronic, but it's a phenomenon that's spreading across the country. You have Seattle Atheist Church, you have North Texas Church of Freethought. These are all places where Americans who have maybe lost faith in a supernatural deity, but are still craving those kind of ingredients that our religious community typically gives you, they will go there. Religion minus the God stuff is how I described it in The Atlantic.
Yeah.
And there's also the Oasis Network, kind of like the Sunday Assembly that was described a little bit ago,
mm-hmm.
Brings together non-believers every Sunday morning. It exists in nine American cities so far and counting.
Seagal Samuel is associate editor who covers faith and also global affairs for The Atlantic. Tim Funk is here from the Charlotte Observer. Sean McLeod from UNC Charlotte. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This started out as a program about the increasing secularization of America, morphed into a program about the increasing number of people who identify as spiritual but not necessarily with a particular sect. I'm not sure where we are right now, but Sean McLeod is here. He's the professor and director of graduate studies at the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Tim Funk is a faith and values reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Seagal Samuel is associate editor of The Atlantic, who writes about religion and more in the pages of that magazine. If there is an increasing secularization or a rising number of people who identify as none of the above, if that is happening in Europe and it's happening in the United States, how much of it has to do with democracy? I mean, I know that democracy allows us to have, at least the American Constitution says, freedom of and freedom from religion. You can practice what you want or not practice at all. But these other freedoms that democracy gives us, how much is that playing in the idea that I don't want to be told what to do and what not to do? Because I have the freedom to make my own choices. I don't need to be preached at from a pulpit.
I could start and say something about that is that while we've had a separation of church and state and free exercise of religion now for well over 200 years,
mm-hmm.
It's only been since after World War II that we've had these kind of shifting demographics and statistics about people switching their religions, becoming no religion. And so rather than democracy, I would wonder if it has more to do with the burgeoning of consumer capitalism, the rhetoric of choice, and the notion of individuals as being free will who can choose whatever they want to buy or practice in ways...
And how about the nationalization of our culture? Because prior to World War II, before the mass media really took a foothold, we were enclaves of individual communities around the country. And where everybody goes to church, you're an outlier if you don't. There's something wrong with you if you're not in church with the rest of us on Sunday morning. But as we became more national in our rhetoric, as blue laws began to fall away and gave us more opportunities to do other things on Sunday morning, the stigma, the peer pressure of not being in church dropped away, and so our true selves emerged. Is that a fair thing to say?
There are still dramatic regional differences in religious practice in the United States, and I think some of that has to do with how certain regions were less, if you want to call it that, nationalized than others, and less susceptible to mediatization.
But, I mean, if you're still living in a small town and everybody goes to the local Baptist or the Methodist or the Presbyterian church and you don't, isn't there a peer pressure for you to go?
Statistics lay out that rural areas tend to have people who say they have higher affiliation than cities, for example. So, yeah.
How big a leap, Seagal, from what you've read and the people you've talked to and what you've written about, how big a leap is it from being a nun, somebody who doesn't identify with a particular faith or a denomination, to being someone who is either agnostic or atheist? And should we include agnostics and atheists in that group of nuns?
Sure. So it's sort of a methodological question. When researchers, like for example at the Pew Research Center, talk about nuns, they use that term interchangeably with religiously unaffiliated, and in that umbrella category, they include atheists, agnostics, and just simply those who, when asked about their religion, say they identify with none in particular. So they kind of lump them under the same heading. I've gotten phone calls and emails from a lot of atheists who this really gets their hackles up, and they don't want to be lumped in with the other guys. So it's kind of funny. People are very sensitive about those identities of theirs. But even within a group like atheists, you have a plurality of opinion, right? And you have some forms of atheism that require more ideological purity, you could call it, some that are more okay with hybridity. So the words themselves are deeply political and sensitive to the people who ascribe them to themselves.
Well, just the fact that we can sit here and talk about atheists and the fact that you have spoken to atheists, it seems to me that that's an indication of how far we've come. Because I remember when atheists, if you said the word, it was almost blasphemy, and they were blasphemous and therefore socially outcast. We didn't talk about them. They didn't come forward. They were in the shadows. Why is that changing?
Well, it is changing, but as recently as 2010, when I did this story on the Charlotte Atheist and Agnostic, I went to their event, and they all wore name tags without their last name. Mm-hmm. They talked about how they were worried about getting fired if people found out they were atheists. They told stories about their family kicking them out because they were atheists. So I don't think that discrimination is completely gone yet. I think, going back to what we were talking before, I think it's basically a marketplace out there. And Sunday is a day to, you could go to your kid's soccer game. You could go and have brunch with your friends. And you could also figure out what church possibilities are out there. There's a church across from the South Park Mall called Sharon United Methodist. They're tearing down their old ski slope building, and they're going to come back, and they've changed their name to South Park Church. And they're going to be in the middle of this big development of apartments and stores and hotels, and they're going to have a performing arts center they'll use on Sunday, and they'll give it to the public the rest of the week. This is how you reach out. You sort of say, hey, look what we have. And then they also have the worship experience. So I think all the churches, all the synagogues and everything are just – it's a marketing phase. It's a changing time in the religious landscape.
Seagal, you just said that some atheists don't like to be lumped in with all these other people who are nuns, N-O-N-E-S's. But you wrote an article in The Atlantic that was headlined, "Atheists are sometimes more religious than Christians." I know that will have a couple of people scratching their heads, but, but this is also based on the findings of a Pew Research study, which found that American nuns identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular, are more religious than their European counterparts. So talk about that. Explain that to me.
Sure, sure. I mean, the headline is admittedly a bit catty, and it's meant to kind of... You said it would have people scratching their heads. And yes, that is exactly the intended purpose. And indeed, I got a lot of people kind of very confused and upset by this. The point, though, is that, you know, and the word sometimes there is crucial, right? They're sometimes more religious than Christians. The point is really that the findings in that Pew study really jostle our traditional understandings of what religiosity means. You know, the study shows, or rather, this is the previous Pew study, the one in April, showed that 18% of American atheists believe in some kind of higher power or spiritual force in the universe. A lot of Christians in Europe would say, no, I absolutely don't believe there's any higher power in the universe. A lot of Christians in Europe identify as Christian, but for them, all that means is that, hey, their parents baptized them when they were a kid, and now it's more of an ethnic identity or a cultural identity than anything else. So the other thing to understand is that when researchers try to measure the levels of religiosity of a given person, they do it by asking multiple questions. So do you pray regularly? Do you believe in God? And when you believe in God, what do you mean by that? Maybe you just believe in some higher power that's also religious or spiritual. How important is religion to you, et cetera? And so when you kind of take the aggregate value of all their responses, it could turn out that someone who identifies as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular will end up being rated as more religious than Christians, say, in Europe, because maybe this atheist prays or meditates every day. Maybe they believe in some kind of higher power with absolute certainty. So it's interesting because it's forcing the researchers to actually realize that in 2018, hey, maybe we have to start asking different questions or drilling down into a more granular level because the traditional measures of religiosity are actually no longer capturing reality because the nature of what it means to be religious or spiritual is changing so much that our old categories just don't map onto reality anymore.
And evidently Webster's has to be revised, Sean,
yes.
Because if Webster's dictionary would define an atheist as a person who does not believe in God or in the existence of a God or of any gods. And yet, as she pointed out in the Pew Research poll, some atheists say they do believe in a God or a higher universal power. Then are they really atheists, or do we need to revise our definition? What is an atheist?
Yeah, this is what we talk about in religious studies. I'm making a plug for my department program, right?
Don't delete this. There's a thing on the screen. I don't want them deleted yet.
Oh, okay. And this is what we've been studying for the last 30 or 40 years, right? Sometimes, given what Segal was talking about, it's more useful sometimes, not always, to talk about supernaturalist and non-supernaturalist, I think, than it is to say atheist and non-atheist, because as she notes, about 20% of all atheists are supernaturalists. They believe in high powers. And we were talking earlier during one of the commercials that while the religiously unaffiliated is going up, so are statistics that people believe in ghosts, demons, and angels.
Mm-hmm.
Those are supernatural beings, right? Two of them are traditionally religious supernatural beings, and yet the belief in those are higher.
And David on Facebook says, atheism is a religion. A Webster definition of religion is simply a belief system. This definition does not require a deity. But is atheism a belief system if they don't believe in God? Is the belief that there is no God a belief system?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into... I would suggest... do religious studies to find out why Webster definitions of religion are probably not the best.
All right. I want to get into something you said a second ago about ethnicity and how people, particularly in Europe, Segal, sometimes feel that their religious identification is more of an ethnicity than it is a religious identification. How much of that has to do with the Catholicism that predominated Europe for much of our times, of much of the last several thousand years? The fact that in Catholicism, you are baptized as an infant. You don't make a choice. You don't heed an altar call to come forward and be saved. You're not baptized as an adult. You're baptized as a child, and you are then raised in that tradition. It becomes part of your fiber. You're just as much a Catholic as you are a Frenchman or an Italian or a German. How much of it has to do with that?
I think that I'm not a historian, but I think a lot. I think that instinct is right. This is a very, very old, deeply rooted way of thinking, especially in Europe, right? Going all the way back at least to the Crusades, if not earlier, where, you know, Christianity was bled into ethnic notions of whiteness. Europeans would look as outsiders, so North Africans, Middle Easterners, as these foreign others who are non-white, non-Christian, and the ethnicity and the religiosity would kind of bleed into one another. The categories become kind of hard to tear apart. Incidentally, we were talking earlier about evangelicals in the U.S. and what Trump means when he says, let's make America great again. We were talking about whether it has to do with religion or race. You know, in America, too, I think there's some amount of, you know, bleeding into one another between ethnic and religious terms. And I'll also just say that it's not just Catholicism by any stretch. I grew up in the Orthodox Jewish tradition in Judaism. If your mother is Jewish, you're born a Jew and you're a Jew for life. It doesn't matter if you later reject all the dogma and call yourself an atheist. As far as the religion is concerned, you're, as my third grade teacher once said, once a Jew, always a Jew.
The Christian right has attached itself, Tim, to the Republican Party, and it seems to be swimming upstream in a society that is changing in terms of its social mores. It's fighting against that, which is why they have attached themselves. If America is changing its mind on things like abortion and same-sex marriage, and it is the Christian right helping to drive more people away from religion? Are they increasing the nuns because people don't want to be identified with that school of thought?
Well, perhaps. I think that some of the rhetoric on the Christian right is pretty judgmental sometimes and sort of combative. But I will say there are a lot of young evangelicals who do not necessarily subscribe to what their parents and grandparents are saying. So I think for the future that may not be as, and I think the religious left can be just as political.
Sure. But the journal Political Research Quarterly, whatever that is, reports that the growth of religious nuns is more common in Republican states where the religious right has more influence. Mm-hmm. So they may be winning battles, but they're losing the war?
Well, right now they're winning because they have a guy in the White House who's sort of doing, trying to put their agenda in order. But, you know, this in 2020, it may go completely the other way. I think there are a lot of young people at some of these conservative churches, but there are also a lot that don't go anymore.
If the number of people not affiliated with church or a denomination increases, is it an inevitable snowball rolling downhill? Is this the demise of religion as we've known it for 2,000, 4,000, 10,000 years? Or are we just taking a little pinprick of history and exaggerating it? Sean?
To say something like that, I think I'll go back to what we've said previously and Sigala's talked about, I've talked about, Tim's talked about, is that religion should not be defined as institutional.
And, you know, we've... In Africa and in the global south, religion is exploding, Christianity is exploding. And even in Charlotte, we have the largest Catholic parish in the United States at St. Matthew's. We have a big Jewish population. So I think we need to keep things in perspective.
Tim Funk with the Charlotte Observer, Faith and Values reporter, Sean McLeod with UNC Charlotte's Religious Studies Department, Sigal Samuel, Associate Editor of The Atlantic. Thank you all for the hour.